I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Oil prices continue to edge downward today after tumbling more than $3 a barrel yesterday. But that hardly means the days of cheap oil are about to return. Across most of the country, a gallon of regular gasoline still costs more than $4, and many families are worried about how to afford heating oil this coming winter. No surprise, then, that we're suddenly hearing a lot of talk about how to satisfy the nation's ravenous energy appetite. This week, the Bush administration proposed opening up public lands in Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming to oil shale development. According to one study, there's more oil buried in the rocky shale in those western states than in all of Saudi Arabia. Last week, former Vice President Al Gore challenged the U.S. to give up its oil addiction and produce all of its electricity from renewable sources like wind and solar power within 10 years. Even oil industry billionaire T. Boone Pickens is urging the nation to stop relying on oil and move towards wind technology.
I've been an oil man my whole life, but this is one emergency we can't drill our way out of. And I have a plan. In the coming weeks, I'm going to share the details of that plan to use American technology and alternative energy to slash our dependency and break foreign oil's stranglehold on us.
Pickens does have a plan. He also has a stake in the project. He's building a multi-billion-dollar wind farm in Texas. Today, we're going to spend some time looking at alternative technologies and how they might one day satisfy our energy needs. Joining us in the studio is Steve Connors. He's a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He works at the MIT Lab for Energy and the Environment. And Steve Connors, welcome.
Thanks.
Let's start with Al Gore's idea, weaning us off of fossil fuels to provide all of our electricity needs within 10 years. Can it be done?
The short answer to that is no. And I think Vice President Gore is trying to really push the debate, and I think he may have pushed it a little bit too far here because everybody's talking about the 10-year target as opposed to how to decarbonize our electricity supply. The 10-year goal is nearly impossible. You know, we could probably do it in terms of the technologies are available. The real question is how fast you could deploy them. And then in some respects, how much would you have to pay the existing oil-fired power plants to turn off? Because essentially they're going to lose 30 or 40 years worth of revenue. And then from our perspective, in terms of being an educational institution and training the engineers and energy experts of tomorrow, we actually don't have those people out there to build the wind farms, to build the new power lines, to meet this 10-year goal, and we're going to have to push really hard to do it in 20 years.
So it's a shortage of expertise more than anything.
It ultimately comes down to who are the people that are going to do it and get paid to do it.
Okay, talk a little bit about this other idea being proposed by the Bush administration, opening up public lands to oil shale development. How does that work?
Well, that's very reminiscent because I think we were talking about that in the late 70s and early 80s. And it's true, there is an awful lot of petroleum bound up in oil shale. The problem is it's probably the worst form of fossil fuel in terms of petroleum to get out because you have to bake it out of the ground. It doesn't flow, and so you have to dig it up and bake it, or some people have proposed using nuclear power and sending the electricity down into the earth to essentially melt that oil out or warm it up until you can pump it out like regular oil.
This sounds like a technology and a way of extracting energy from the earth that would have enormous environmental consequences.
Oh, and just the energy balance alone is not very good. So it's not cheap, and yes, it will have a big environmental impact. And if you had all that electricity and it was carbon-free, which you'd kind of need, you might as well just use that straight away anyway.
Okay, Steve, well, we've asked you in to help us talk about the practicality of several alternative energy ideas that we're going to hear about in the next few minutes. So we're going to hear about them, then come back to you and talk about them. So let's first hear from Terry Kinney. His idea is to tap the energy created by big, heavy trucks as they rumble over the roadway. Kinney now has a pilot project running at the Port of Oakland in California, which he says produces enough energy to power 20 homes a day, but could eventually power 16,000. Terry Kinney told us about his project, which he calls the Dragon Power Station. Let's listen.
The portion of the Dragon that is put into the roadway, it's a concrete vault, and it drops 2 to 3 feet down in the roadway. And then inside that concrete vault is a steel mechanism that has small steps in it, if you will. Each step is coupled with a generator, and those individual steps are compressed a certain amount of depth, and it captures the weight and the speed of the truck at the same time and moves a generator, which puts out electrical power. And just like solar puts power onto the grid through inverters, we use the same process. So it's really a straightforward process from the pressure of a truck crossing the roadway to inverters and then to the grid. And so what you see when you drive over it is a small ripple in the road that looks like maybe a small series of speed bumps.
Could you set this up on the highway where hundreds of cars will be speeding by in the space of an hour? I mean, is there a reason why you're picking trucks?
Well, trucks are, first of all, most of these trucks that we're targeting weigh 80,000 pounds, and the weight has a lot to do with it. And they have five axles, whereas most cars weigh about anywhere from, as you know, 5,000 to, you know, 8,000 pounds.
I see. So you get more power, and then you get more sort of up and down motion on the plates as the trucks rumble across them.
Absolutely.
Do you see this project one day as being able to contribute in a significant way on energy consumption?
Absolutely. The application we're doing at the Otay Mesa border between San Diego and Mexico, their power consumption for the side of the terminal that we're doing is about 6,000 kilowatt hours a day. We're going to come right in around 4,000 to 5,000 kilowatt hours a day. So we're going to almost make them independent from the grid just on our first run.
Okay, that was Terry Kinney, creator of the Dragon Power Station, and Steve Connors of the MIT Energy Lab is still with us. This sounds too good to be true, just tapping the power of trucks rumbling down the road. How realistic does this sound to you?
It's somewhat realistic in the sense that the number of houses you power depends on the number of these concrete vaults he can install. So in some respects, when we look at technologies like this, we're looking at what niche does it fill. One of the phrases we use whenever we evaluate new technologies like this and other is every market's a niche market. Some niches are just bigger than others. And it's important to remember that we have to go through these early adopter phases to see whether something has a big market long term as the technology develops. For this particular technology and some of the others we'll look at, we look at these and say, is there sort of a free energy or ambient energy source? It may be renewable, it might be the trucks or something else, that we can capture a little bit of that energy as it goes by. So his innovation is well, these trucks entering and leaving the port or crossing a border station, they have to go over speed bumps or something anyway. Is there a way to capture that energy?
Right.
And is the technology he's using to convert essentially the speed bumps going up and down into energy is the same basic energy conversion system that they're thinking about for wave energy systems.
Say more about that, wave energy systems.
Well, essentially there's a lot of energy in waves too, things going up and down. And the question is, how do you convert that up and down motion into essentially rotary motion that then you can turn a generator and generate some electricity?
Okay, let's hear another idea. This comes from 23-year-old Elizabeth Redmond of Chicago. She's invented something called Power Leap. It's a sidewalk tile that lights up when people walk across it. And she believes that this technology could one day help power a city. She explained that Power Leap uses something called piezoelectricity, which creates an electrical charge in certain materials when pressure is applied to them. So let's hear from her right now.
Well, essentially, Power Leap uses the technology of piezoelectrics to generate electricity from human motion. So as people step upon the Power Leap tiles, they're generating electricity instantaneously that can be used for the public electric grid.
It's the same technology that's used in the heels of those children's shoes that light up. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's the same idea. Actually, the most common known piezoelectric effect is the wintergreen certs, and when you bite down on them, they spark. And that's actually a piezoelectric reaction that creates that spark, which is just a small electric charge. When used on a larger scale, you can generate some electricity.
Do you see this project as having an impact on a grander scale? I mean, we mentioned at the top of this segment that you have an idea that this could help light up a city, for example. How far away are we from that?
Well, we're a little ways away. Essentially, it's learning how to store the energy and when it will be most efficiently used and when it would be most efficiently stored. I absolutely see it on a larger scale. And one of the most exciting potentials in this is that we're generating electricity on site. So we're not requiring so much electricity to be pumped out from generation sites way, way, way far away from cities.
23-year-old designer Elizabeth Redman talking about Power Leap, Steve Connors of the MIT Energy Lab. What do you think? How viable is this kind of technology?
These kind of technologies, the piezoelectric technologies, are very common, and they give you a little bit of electricity, but they really only give you many millivolts. They don't give you kilowatt hours, and you get a little bit more out of the Terry Kinney's thing. So when I look at this one, actually I start thinking about energy vampires. And so there's a lot of energy we use in our home, much more than we should be using, to charge batteries for night lights and things like that. And that's hooked to the grid, and that's the equivalent of delivering a pizza using an 18-wheeler. So there's just some way we can match the electricity demand, in this case a small trickle charge set of electricity demand, to do emergency lighting, to keep batteries charged, and not have to hook that stuff into the grid where it's consuming 5 watts or something, which doesn't sound like a lot. But if you look at all the little LEDs that glow in our house with charging batteries all night long, it adds up to a lot of energy over the country over an entire year.
Sure. These concepts are part of a trend called energy harvesting, right? I mean, this idea of Power Leap. What are some other examples that are already being used commercially?
Well, I mean, I think the one you probably see is where you have all these little photovoltaic panels hooked up to roadway signs and to the sensors along the road. So if you're powering sensors, then you can do this, and you're not really worrying about the cents per kilowatt hour that you and I pay for electricity. It's really to provide that service, and it tends to be information technologies or emergency services.
I want to talk to you about an op-ed in today's New York Times by Glenn Smith. He's a former manager for the International Space Station at NASA, and he says we can use something that he calls space solar power. What is that, and is it fact or fiction?
Well, we certainly have space solar power already. I mean, we use photovoltaic panels to power the space station, to power most of the satellites and what have you that have you in orbit. Now, again, those are things that don't use a lot of electricity, but then if you put the solar panel up in orbit where the sun is stronger and shines all day, and you're not really that cost sensitive when you're in orbit either, then that's not too bad. Trying to compete against grid power with orbiting solar is a bit trickier. To take a solar panel you'd have on your roof and put it into orbit, the energy balance sort of goes away, because you can think about taking something that weighs several hundred pounds and carrying it up a flight of stairs 200 kilometers high and then throwing it sideways with the speed that it falls over the Earth. That's the amount of energy it takes to get something in orbit. And so that's a little bit tricky. So if they think that getting things in orbit is going to get really cheap and hopefully energy efficient, that's pretty good. Sort of the other sci-fi approach to this is, well, maybe we have robotic manufacturing of this stuff on the moon. We're already pretty much in orbit already, because the gravity on the moon is such less, and then you move it into orbit from that. I mean, we're talking about something that we don't do once, but can, as you said, supply a city worth of electricity. And what do those options look like?
We're speaking with Steve Connors of MIT about the brave new world of alternative energy. We'll hear more from him when we return after a short break, as well as about some other ideas in the pipeline. You're listening to Here and Now. We're talking about alternative forms of energy today, beyond wind turbines and solar panels. With mounting energy costs, investors are sinking their money into these new technologies. In fact, the National Venture Capital Association reports that in the first quarter of this year, their investors pumped about $625 million into alternative energy products. They're all looking for the next big thing. Steve Connors of the MIT Laboratory for Energy and the Environment is in the studio with us to give us a reality check on some of these new technologies. We'll hear more from him in a moment. But first, we're going to hear from another young inventor. 27-year-old Sean Frain has developed a new type of wind technology called a wind belt, much smaller and cheaper than traditional wind turbines. He hopes it will one day replace kerosene that more than a billion people in the developing world use to light their homes. We reached Sean on his internet phone in his Hong Kong office. He explained how a wind belt is different from giant wind turbines.
The wind belt technology looks a little more akin to, you can think of it as the bow of a musical instrument or a guitar string vibrating in the wind, and that's how we're able to extract energy from flowing air. As opposed to having a spinning airfoil, we have a vibrating membrane.
Okay, Sean, so I have a picture of this vibrating membrane. How does that actually create electricity?
So the membrane's acting kind of as the net that's grabbing the energy in that airflow. What happens then is a bit more conventional in that using that membrane to move magnets or coils. Basically, it's a type of electromagnetic generator that works in a linear way.
So where do you see this technology being used? How do you see it being used?
So initially, the technology was developed to focus on providing very, very inexpensive alternatives to what's typically used to light rural homes right now, which is kerosene or paraffin lamps. A lot of families will spend between $5 to $10, depending on the region, on kerosene fuel costs. So the idea was, what if we can design an all-in system that costs 1 month's worth of kerosene expenditure, so $5 to $10, and provide a way to capture some energy, store that energy, and use that energy to power some white LEDs or charge a cell phone or power a radio. So part of the objective is to satisfy those sorts of goals.
I see. Now, when you say a $5 investment, you're talking about a one-time investment or a monthly investment?
That's right. The goal was that to design a system that it would be a one-time investment for a family.
And how much power would the wind belt create? You said it might power a radio, some lights. Could it light a whole house, for example?
Well, it could light a whole house if you were trying to match the light output of kerosene, which was the original goal.
You mentioned the plans are to get this technology up and going in developing countries, but could it one day be used to generate larger amounts of energy in the first world, for example? I mean, might this be a solution for homes in a suburban tract in the United States one day?
Powering homes is one option in the future, but we're kind of focusing at the lowest hanging fruit, so to speak, for the developed country applications, which can be anything from a very small wind belt generator about the size of a pack of gum that could power wireless sensors that you would have in the heating and ventilation ducting of a building. You can imagine wind belt systems on the scale of 1 to 10 watts that could power Wi-Fi routers in, you know, Central Park if you didn't want to, you know, run a hard line. Then we are working with a couple groups in Guatemala right now on larger scale systems that, you know, would address, I think, what you're getting at, which is, can the wind belt technology power homes in the U.S.?
Well, Sean, it's fascinating. Thank you for talking to us about this.
Thank you very much.
Again, that was Sean Frain, and we're still joined by Steve Connors of the MIT Energy Lab. And Steve, what do you think? Same question to you. He's talking about powering rural homes, essentially lighting rural homes. Does this technology offer potential to do something bigger in the developed world?
I think it does. And I saw Sean present this stuff last summer at MIT, and it's one of my favorite topics because I was actually a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa reading using kerosene lamps, working on appropriate technologies back in the 80s. And there's been some interesting studies that technologies like this, if you compare it on the cost per unit of light, the cents per lumen instead of cents per kilowatt hour, they actually come out ahead. And if he's aiming at not the cost of lighting, but just the cost versus kerosene, this is pretty interesting. This does come back to your comment about this is another energy harvesting device. So you're not going to get a lot of electricity, but I think what Sean's picked up on here is what's happened is that lighting, white LEDs and electronic devices can actually be powered by one of these smallish generators. And of course, for a developing country household, this is something that's much more affordable and much more applicable than sort of giving a small wind turbines or a solar panel to a developing country family.
Okay, Steve, so there were three interesting examples of alternative energy. What's the takeaway from all three of them? What do we learn? What do we have to understand?
Well, I've got two takeaways from these examples plus renewable energy, and that is really energy production and energy use is situational. And so don't think about these technologies on average. Think about where the technology matches the energy supply and the energy need. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, and you can target the application, well, that's where it's going to be most cost effective. So we don't come at this from averages anymore. What's the average sun? Well, it's not sunny at night, so average doesn't mean so much.
I see. Interesting. Well, Steve Connors, thanks so much for being our guide through this thicket of alternative energy ideas. Much appreciated. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
That's Steve Connors. He's a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Laboratory for Energy and the Environment, which is part of MIT's new campus-wide energy initiative. And we've been talking to him about alternative energy technologies. And to see pictures and read more about some of these new technologies, go to our website, here-now.org. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Still ahead today, the Marine Corps Suicide Prevention Program. It's now part of boot camp. That's just ahead. We'll be back after the news. It's Here and Now. The Department of Veterans Affairs has set up this special hotline following criticism that it was neglecting the mental health needs of veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
You have reached the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you are in emotional distress or suicidal crisis, or are concerned about someone who might be, the Lifeline is here to help. If you are a U.S. military veteran, or if you're calling about a veteran, please press 1 now.
During a recent 8-month period, nearly 38,000 callers pressed 1, which put them in touch with counselors who in many cases were able to intervene and prevent suicides. That support is available to veterans after they come home. And now the Marine Corps is trying to address the problem before they're deployed. A recent story in the Los Angeles Times highlights the Marine Corps Suicide Prevention Program that starts in boot camp at Camp Pendleton. Tony Perry is the paper's San Diego bureau chief. He wrote the stories. And Tony, first of all, give us a sense of the problem. How many U.S. Marines are committing suicide?
Well, it's a lower number than proportionally than the civilian population or the active duty Army. Last year, it was 33 Marines killed themselves. In the first 6 months of this year, 25 have killed themselves. So if that trend continues, it could be the highest number, certainly since the Afghanistan war began in 2001.
So the Marines acknowledge this is a problem that they have to take seriously and do something about.
Oh, absolutely. It's a societal problem, of course. Those people most vulnerable to suicide are young males. Young males under stress, young males being tested, young males with access to weapons. All of those definitions fit young Marines starting in boot camp. They know this is an issue. It's an issue when you're stateside, and it's certainly an issue when you're in either Iraq or Afghanistan.
You write that at least 168 Marines have committed suicide since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. So how is the Marine Corps responding to this?
Well, it's responding in a number of ways, and it was doing much of this even before Afghanistan, but is amping it up now. Advanced training for corpsmen, for medical corpsmen, for chaplains, for sergeants, for corporals. But the first line of defense against suicide is the young Marine himself, that he watches his buddy, that he watches him to see if he's heading towards a despair that'll lead him into making a decision to kill himself. So the training really begins in boot camp. By the second week, they've gathered them together and started to talk to them about the signs of suicide and what to do if your bud seems to be showing some of these. Then they have discussions with their drill instructors, those grouchy, intimidating figures of legend. But for a discussion of suicide, they put that aside, and the drill instructors stop the grouchiness and become sort of older brothers and talk to the young recruits.
You know, you touch on something that strikes me, and it came out in your reporting. You write that the basic rule for Marine boot camp is pretty simple. You keep your mouth shut, you follow orders, you mind your own business. But in this case, the recruits are being asked, in a sense, to do the opposite. They're supposed to be on the lookout for suicidal tendencies in their buddies, and then to speak up. Isn't that a tough sell to these kids who are probably, you know, gung-ho to approach this a different way?
It is a tough sell, but I think they've got a good sales mechanism, if you will, and that is they say you owe it to the Marine Corps, you owe it to the unit, you owe it to the loyalty you're starting to feel for your company to spot a buddy who's in trouble and to speak up and to do everything you can. As one of the chaplains said, we lose the equivalent of a rifle platoon every year to suicide. Hmm. They put it in those terms. They also say, even if your buddy says, don't tell the sergeant that I'm thinking of killing myself, your loyalty to the unit, to the Corps, beats your individual loyalty to that buddy.
Well, Tony, you attended and watched one of these training sessions. Give us a sense of what happened there.
Well, 72 young recruits who've had a hard day of calisthenics and training and this and that, they're gathered together in the barracks, and one of the senior drill instructors asked them, for example, how many have had some experience in their lives with someone who has committed suicide or has tried to. Nearly a third of them raised their hands with some really gritty experiences. One young recruit came home and his mother was hanging by her neck. Mm. Another one, his grandfather killed himself, and a whole bunch had to wrestle weapons away from friends in civilian life. So suicide is not an unknown issue to these young people. They give them further indication of what are the signs. The signs are depressive talk, I have nothing to live for, start to give away your stuff. They even do some role playing. They've got a corporal playing the role of someone who wants to kill himself and a private playing the role of his buddy who has to do something. So it really seems to be a lot of back and forth. And then when it's over, of course, they hustle off to the chow hall and they're back to being recruits doing what they're told every minute of the day.
Now, is there a sort of common theme behind the talk or the fear about suicide? In other words, is this stuff they bring to the Marine Corps from their private lives, or is it sort of understood that this is going to be the result of the pressure they will face as they go forward toward deployment?
A little of both. A lot of these young men have come from families that are not Ozzie and Harriet, or not the sure. Huxtables. Some families with some real solid issues, and they've come to the Marine Corps to find shape and meaning to their lives. And then in the Marine Corps, it's tough. It's stressful. Within 18 months, they're going to be in Iraq or Afghanistan. And then, of course, when they start to hear of buddies who've come back, maybe wounded, maybe dead, that increases the stress. And then, of course, the inevitable Dear John letter. These young men are going to feel a lot of stresses, a lot of strains. What they have to know is that there's people there in uniform to help them who care about them. And that really is the message of the training that begins in boot camp, continues through pre-deployment, continues once you're in Iraq, and then continues when you're ready to come home from Iraq or Afghanistan and you go through what they call warrior transition. Mm-hmm. When they come home, and the vast majority of suicides occur stateside, not in country, not in Iraq or Afghanistan, when they come home can be a very emotionally troubling period. Mm-hmm. The Marine Corps tries to walk them through that in the States.
And of course, the kind of support they're offering doesn't always work. We mentioned 168 Marines have committed suicide since 2003. You wrote about a specific case of suicide in which a young Marine, 20 years old, who killed himself in Iraq. What happened to him?
Well, he was, in many ways, what makes him remarkable was that he was not remarkable. He really didn't show the classic signs of talking about nothing to live for, giving away your stuff, talking about killing yourself. He didn't do any of that. And I talked to the number 2 chaplain for the 1st Marine Division, and he said that the classic signs really don't appear in a lot of cases. The Army study says in less than half cases. What he says, they're not really predictors of suicide. They're requests to have someone care about them. Well, in this case, it didn't happen. The Marines were all too busy getting ready to come home. This young Marine wasn't a great performer. He got caught not paying attention on guard duty, a very significant lapse of judgment, 1, 2, 3 times, and then he was told to write individual letters of apology to guys in his platoon, and instead he killed himself. Hmm. Very tragic, but not altogether uncommon phenomena.
Well, Tony Perry, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
That's Tony Perry. He's San Diego Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. For more on his stories about the Marine Suicide Prevention Program, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And you're listening to Here and Now. Lawyers for the nationalist Serbian leader Radovan Karadzic said today that Karadzic can't wait to defend himself in court against the United Nations war crimes charges. Karadzic is in a cell in Belgrade today, arrested after 13 years on the run. A sometime psychiatrist and poet, Karadzic became a Serbian nationalist military commander during the Bosnian War. He's going to be extradited to the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, where he faces 11 charges of genocide and crimes against humanity for ethnic cleansing. Among the key charges is that he masterminded the massacre at Srebrenica, where Serb paramilitary forces murdered as many as 8,000 Muslim men and boys. 33-year-old Muhammed Durakovic escaped from Srebrenica that night by fleeing through the forests with his father. And Muhammed joins us now on the line from Srebrenica. And Muhammed, did you think this day would come? Did you ever think you'd finally see Karadzic brought to justice?
Honestly, I was taken by surprise that Karadzic has been finally apprehended.
So give us a sense of what your first reaction was when you heard that he was captured.
At first, everybody felt some sort of relief that finally the justice has been done towards all the victims of Karadzic and his regime. And afterwards, when that feelings kind of fade away, then you realize that we're still in Bosnia and Herzegovina. We're still a country that has been ruined by his politics, and we're still a country where hundreds of thousands of lives have been destroyed, and not only people that are paid the ultimate price with their life, but the people whose lives also have been destroyed. They managed to survive the war, but their lives were never the same.
Mohammed, we spoke to you about 3 years ago on the 10th anniversary of the massacre at Srebrenica about your escape. Back then, you told us that the arrest of Karadzic would be merely symbolic. Do you still think that it's merely symbolic, or does it mean more than symbolism?
I think it's very important for the international community, as well as victims of genocide of Bosnia and Herzegovina, that key players in that event are apprehended. But let's not forget the fact that we live in Bosnia today, which is a direct result of ethnic cleansing. We live in two entities, and entity called Republika Srpska is a direct result of his politics of ethnic cleansing. So symbolism of arresting him is not going to erase the results of his activities.
So will the capture of Karadzic help Bosnia reunite? As you suggested, Bosnia is divided between a Bosnian entity and a Serb entity. Are you hopeful that one day this could move Bosnia closer to some kind of unification?
I think it is important, the apprehension of Radovan Karadzic. And let's not forget Ratko Mladic, who was his military commander, who is still at large. It is an important event how for the victims of Bosnian atrocities, as well as for the Serb population that lives in Bosnia and Herzegovina. I think for a long time, Karadzic and Mladic have been burdened on this population. And finally, some people among the Serb population will be able to move on and maybe work closer with the rest of Bosnian population to build Bosnia together. I'm an optimist when I think about the future of Bosnia and Herzegovina, but much has to be done in this particular matter.
Well, given that it was Serb police forces that captured him, I'm wondering if you think that fact that Serbs captured him could help heal some of the wounds between Bosnian Muslims and Bosnian Serbs.
You know, arrest of Radovan Karadzic is a purely political move on the part of a Serbian government. And they're, of course, looking towards, joining European Union. So no wonder that only 10 days after the government has been formed, this arrest came. I believe that Radovan Karadzic will get a fair trial in the Hague Tribunal. How this is going to impact Bosnia and Herzegovina is yet to be seen. But I definitely believe that this could be the beginning of the end of bloodshed that took place in 1992.
Well, let's hope you're right. Mohammed, thank you for talking to us today.
You're welcome.
That's Mohammed Durakovic. He's a survivor of the massacre at Srebrenica, the site where Bosnian Serb forces killed 8,000 civilians in 1995. And there's more ahead. Stay with us here and now. In his satirical novel New Bedlam, Bill Flanagan takes on a world that he knows better than anyone, the television business. When he's not writing, Flanagan is an MTV vice president and a commentator for CBS Sunday Morning. New Bedlam tells the story of Bobby Kahn, a rising executive who's fired from his network television job because of a reality TV scandal. Desperate to salvage his career, he takes a job with King Cable, owned by an eccentric family in New Bedlam, Rhode Island. Bobby's job is to turn around King Cable's ratings, a daunting challenge due to the horrendous quality of the programs King Cable produces. New Bedlam comes out in paperback next week, and we spoke to Bill Flanagan when it was first published last year. I asked him about his satire of the TV business and if he wasn't biting the hand that feeds him.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I think that, Hemingway drove an ambulance for a while, and Melville worked in the Custom House. There's a long tradition of novelists taking the world that they work in and turning it into fiction, so I don't think anybody's too offended.
It does paint, though, an unflattering picture of TV executives, to say the least. You're a television executive yourself. There must be something about this business you enjoy.
As Nietzsche said when they asked him how he could rail against philosophers when he was a philosopher, how else would I know?
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot I enjoy about it. You know, one of the funny things is that in the book, there are some characters who are very anti-television and I think make a really strong anti-television case. There are other characters who love TV and think that if you don't like it, well, you know, it's like being against the internal combustion engine. It's just too bad for you because this is the way the world works. I guess, you know, in a way, I feel like a public defender. My job is to make the most articulate case I can for whoever I'm standing in front of the bar defending.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what happens in the book. In New Bedlam, we mentioned earlier that the King Cable product was unwatchable. And I want to give listeners an idea. Its main components are Boomerbox, a classic TV channel where the biggest product is Bonanza. Then there's Eureka, an arts channel which you describe as, quote, like being trapped in a college course on the history of pottery where the windows did not open and the professor talked like Beowulf. And the comic book channel, which happens to be my personal favorite, in which sort of anti-social types sit around and talk about comic books.
There was a minute when I was first writing the book when it was going to be entirely the comic book channel. And I decided that was just going to be a little too much of a good thing. Then it was a matter of trying to think of channels that did not already exist, which was tough enough. You know, you've pretty much got the roller derby channel somewhere, and the channels that would be fun to fill up with fictitious programming. And the comic book channel was the first one, and Boomerbox just is kind of a way to riff on old TV itself. And Eureka, in a way, was the most fun to make fun of, because to some degree, making fun of superhero fans is shooting fish in a barrel. But
right.
I really had the most fun kind of making fun of the pretentious intellectuals of Eureka who are putting on shows about medieval tapestry weaving and thinking that they're contributing to the enlightenment of a decadent culture.
And they're not. Come on, Bill. This is public radio.
Well, you know, there's a shoe to fit everyone in this book.
Yet when you think about it, none of these, I mean, of course, these are products of your imagination, but they're not so far beyond the realm of reality.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, in a way, I fell over laughing when I thought of the comic book channel. Initially, it's sort of two guys who will never have a girlfriend sitting around arguing about sequential art and graphic novels. And then, you know, part of the rhythm of the book is the network exec coming in and sort of cleaning up the town and trying to turn it into a successful franchise. Which, you know, in a way has happened with lots of channels. From Bravo, which was at one time pretty much, as I remember, classical music and ballet on ice, to FX, which was just sort of science fiction stuff. These channels have all been successfully grown into really across the board very, very successful national networks. That's what Bobby Kahn's assignment is with the comic book channel and everything else. And, you know, part of the book is what do you do, given the worst TV channels in the country? How do you polish them up? How do you clean them up? How do you make these antisocial characters into functioning and successful television executives?
Well, let's go back to your hero, Bobby Kahn. He deeply loves television, yet he continually makes morally questionable decisions. And at one point, one of your other characters in the book, Boris, who works on the comic book channel, muses on the nature of television executives. And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind reading that passage to us. It's the one that begins, is it bottom of page 271?
I've got it here.
Good.
Boris had learned a lot about making television since Bobby Kahn came to town. One thing he learned was that successful TV executives never admit to one another or to anyone else that they are making garbage. If you have a hit reality show devoted to mocking a gorgeous woman for being hilariously stupid, you always say, "Isn't she adorable? There's something so sweet and real about her that the audience just loves." If you have a series devoted to making fun of a bunch of fat kids trying to play sports, you look at the screen and say, "I love their determination. When poor little Howie fell into that mud pile and all the kids laughed at him, my heart was breaking." Now, the truth was that you, as producer, probably paid an intern to push Howie into the mud pile, and you planned to use that shot for a tune-in promo. But etiquette demanded that you never, ever cop to it. Successful TV executives did not drop their masks. In that way, Boris thought, they were very much like supervillains.
That's not going to get
probably
you in trouble with it.
The worst thing you could ask me to read, considering I have to go back to work now.
Sound like, I mean, how can I ask this? How much do you identify with Boris's point of view?
Boris has got a point. Yeah. You know, it's not true of everything. And, sure. You know, one of the kind of jokes of the book is that Boris ends up being the one guy from the comic book channel who ends up becoming a very successful television producer because he figures it out. But, you know, I have noticed that on the sort of theater of humiliation shows that go on a lot of reality TV, when you meet the producers of those shows, that's their attitude. They will never say, "We're mocking those people," no matter how obvious it is they're mocking them. They always defend it, and they always take this sort of sweeter-than-thou position of, "Oh, I just think America finds her adorable. She's the girl next door." You go, "What are you talking about, she's the girl next door? She just drove drunk through somebody's plate glass window and ran over their dog." Oh, you know, we've all done that, haven't we?
One more thing. Your novel is set in the fictional town of New Bedlam, Rhode Island. I know you're from Warwick, Rhode Island. Why was Rhode Island? I mean, beyond the obvious fact that you know Rhode Island because that's where you're from, it seems to me there's something extremely appropriate that this book is set in.
Because Rhode Island's a nutty place.
Yeah.
You know?
I couldn't say that, not being from Rhode Island, but this is what I'm,
you know,
this is where I was trying to go.
People who live in New England or New York, I think, know that. I people in Wisconsin may not. But Rhode Island is a famously nutty place. It always was. It was begun as a colony for outcasts. It almost refused to join the revolution because they wanted to be their own country, even though it's, you know, 50 miles by 35 miles. And I have to give my editor, Scott Moyers, a lot of credit because I came in with the idea and I said, I want to do a story about a network hotshot who gets disgraced and has to go work at the worst cable channels in the world for a crazy family. And Scott said, "Great, but you got to set it in Rhode Island." He said, "The stories you tell about the Rhode Islanders, just the way if we have lunch, you'll tell me you won't believe what went down in Providence this week." he said, "You know, you got to make that the book." And as soon as he said it, I knew it was exactly right because it allowed me as a writer to really have both perspectives. I know how the New York TV guy sees the world, but even better, I know how the characters in New Bedlam, Rhode Island see the world, and I know what they would make of this guy, and I know where they would learn from him and where they would undermine him and how they would ultimately how they would do him in.
That's Bill Flanagan. His book New Bedlam comes out in paperback next week. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again Here and Now.